Okay, let's turn to the questions from the audience. Try to keep your answers as tight as you can. What was the federal government's best and worst economic decision during the Obama administration? Christy.
Have some water.
All right, well, let me start with what I think was a really important one, which was the Recovery Act. So I know it is a controversial piece of legislation, but I will tell you, I think it was highly effective. And if you had been sitting in my job in December and January of 2000, December of 2008 and January of 2009, you'd have been very worried because we not only were at the edge of a precipice, we were on the way down very fast. And I think the evidence as it has come out is that the Recovery Act was indeed helpful. It wasn't perfect. It could have been designed better. I sure wish it had been bigger, but I actually think it made a huge difference to what ended up happening. The other thing I would mention, and this I will actually give a shout out to the previous administration, because I actually think the other even more hated piece of legislation was the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Right, there's a name that will kill anything, but it was passed in a hurry. What it was passed as ended up not what it was used as. But it is one of the things that helped save the US economy. So if you remember back to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and financial firms were in very precarious position, and this is one of those times people were able to come together. And I guess that's the only reason why I'm not quite as depressed as maybe the rest of the people on the panel, because I saw that when the going was really tough, and when someone said, when the Secretary of the Treasury and the Chairman of the Fed said, if you don't do this, we are going down, Congress found a way to do it. It took them two votes. It took a big crash of the stock market in between, but by golly, they finally did it. And what it did was basically give a bunch of money. We were able to put money into financial institutions. Importantly, almost all of it came back, but what it did was stabilize them. It was money that you could put in so you could say, look, people, there's a lot more capital in these institutions. And I give it, it wasn't an Obama administration program, though we inherited it and we fought to get it continued. But I think it was really important, and as hated as it was, we should all be very grateful that it was passed.
Michael, I'm not going to push her on the worst decision, but I'd like to ask you what you think the worst decision
was. Well, by the way, I agree that there were many antecedents that caused us to be in the situation we were, and administrations and both parties and the private sector all bear some responsibility for getting us to the financial crisis and the collapse after Lehman Brothers. But I do believe if we didn't put capital into the banks, that we would have had a big problem. I think it was done very poorly. And I'm critical of my own party for the Treasury Secretary for how it was done and forcing it all on banks that need it. But I do think it was unfortunately necessary. I think the Fed deserves some credit for lowering interest rates in the early part of quantitative easing. I think the latter parts have been very ineffective and have created a lot more risk in the economy and a much more complicated exit for very small, diminishing and maybe even smaller, essentially zero returns. I think that to be fair and generous in the midst of a crisis, there's a lot of incoming information. You're not quite sure what's going to happen. You're doing your best. And so some leeway for some experimentation and some things working and some not. But there were some that were pretty bad failures, in my opinion. The program to relieve toxic assets from the banks, which was going to come 50% from the private sector, 50% from the federal government, subsidized with non-recourse federal loans, raised 3% of the money it was supposed to raise, and was basically inconsequential. That was a program a month after. Cash for Clunkers was originally sold as a great way to help the auto industry, and then when it moved up sales a few months, then they collapsed after it ended. The response was, it's great for the environment, but we paid 20 times the European Union carbon trading price per ton of CO2 emitted. So there were a lot of those things. I also, I think that the time when discretionary fiscal policy of the type Christy was referring to in the Recovery Act might work best is in a deep recession when the Fed's at the zero lower bound, and it certainly got enacted, but it was spent slowly. The maximum increase in purchases of goods and services in 2009 when it was meted the most was 0.2% of GDP. As President Obama said, the shovels weren't ready. In fact, it turns out that modern public infrastructure projects don't use shovels anymore. And they're not very labor intensive, and the skills that people have in home building aren't readily transferable to large public infrastructure projects. So that was more hopeful, and it didn't work out. So again, I want to be fair. There was a lot going on, and there were pluses and minuses, and we ought to allow some scope for some things not working out so well. But there were a couple of, like cash for clunkers and the toxic asset purchase program, that were pretty bad.
Let me ask you.
Can I just jump in for one second
sure.
here? Which is, it's really important to remember that a third of the Recovery Act was tax cuts, right? And those went out the minute they were passed. Another third was either state to local aid to state and local governments, or unemployment insurance, or those kind of things. So I will agree that a lot of the shovels weren't moving, but there was a big chunk that got out quickly.
Bob,
I have to quickly answer this. there are many
soon
studies
we're going to arm wrestle.
Many studies that show. I mean, if you look at what happened contemporaneously, there was a big increase in disposable income and no change in consumption. So we can argue there are many studies. Economists debate this as perhaps more fiercely than any subject in economics. So we'll just agree to disagree. I think it wasn't as successful as it might have been for different reasons than Christie's emphasizing, which she wanted it to have been larger.
Okay, let me ask, Bob, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. The approach that was taken, particularly with the passage of Dodd-Frank, was that we have to get away from too big to fail. If we ought to allow companies to fail. But I guess my question is, if we face the same kind of crisis in our economy as we did then today, would you do anything differently?
Yes, and again, it's easy in hindsight to say they should have done that or should have done this, but the biggest banks are far bigger today than they were then. The five biggest banks in the United States had, in 1990, 5% of all banking assets. Today, the five biggest banks have 44% of banking assets. They are now too big to fail, clearly too big to fail. And any bank that's too big to fail is just too big, period. I would use the leverage the Fed has to increase capital requirements and to actually break up the biggest banks. I think that's very, very important, Leon, right now. We should not get to the point where we have another too big to fail crisis. I just want to mention something about what happened to homeowners, because TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program, was designed partly to relieve homeowners who were in trouble, who were underwater, who didn't have, who owed more than their houses suddenly became worth. And very little was done for homeowners. I mean, the banks got bailed out, but the homeowners didn't, by and large. I think that's probably partly to do, and Christy knows more about this, but the question of what conditions were or were not placed on the big banks in return for getting the bailouts, I think that there should have been much more restrictive conditions, including homeowners, no executive bonuses, no lobbying against Dodd-Frank or financial regulation. I mean, you guys got bailed out, for crying out loud, and you've got to be publicly responsible. And I don't think we had that.
If you'd had asked me the question of what did we do wrong, I would have mentioned homeowners. I that is the thing that makes me sad that we didn't ever come in. We tried, but we didn't come up with as effective a program for homeowners. I think the one thing you have to understand that made it hard is we talk so much about inequality. And when you think about homeowners, even though a lot of them were really suffering, they're by and large, the top half of the income distribution. And it was a hard decision to figure out if you've got a limited amount of money, Are those the people
give
you want?
Give it to the banks.
No. And the money from the banks came back, so just keep that in mind. But that is what made it hard.
But you know, we also remember nobody knew. This was a completely, there were no precedents. And in fairness, I mean, everybody was flying blind. I remember I was testifying, Marty Feldstein was testifying, Mark Zandi, two Republican economic advisors, I was testifying, and the question was, how large should the stimulus package be? And Marty Feldstein, Republican, was asked first, and he said $800 billion. And I turned to the other fellow who was just about to testify, I said, where did Marty get $800 billion from? And he said, I have no idea. And then they asked him, and he said, $800 billion. Because Marty Feldstein had said $800 billion. So they came to me, and I said, $800 billion. So it was unanimous, but we had no idea what we were talking about. And how big was the fine? Well, how big was the
$800 billion.
Of course.
$821 billion. As we've all said, there was a lot of chaos. It was very hard to predict the future, as our greatest of all American philosophers once said, Yogi Berra. Predictions are tough, especially about the future, and in that situation, they were harder than normal. So you have to allow some things weren't going to work. But we should go back and evaluate them all and try to learn from them for the next time. An old idea we used to have that unfortunately never came about and has wound up being running the risk of getting politicized with all the other issues you mentioned, Leon, and a dysfunctional Washington, was to have a shelf of pre-approved projects that could be accelerated in a recession that passed stringent national cost-benefit tests. But if we could prevent that from being politicized, that might be one way to improve the efficiency of these things, for example.
Actually, there's a question that I have here that along those lines. During the Great Depression, with large numbers of people out of work, FDR formed the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, to expand and improve the infrastructure of the country. Why then does this government not provide that type of option when the need for both is so obvious? Alan?
Well, I don't know, but I live in the land of what they did, the CCC camps. California has many of them in their mountain areas and wooded areas. And the guys that were doing the work were on Wall Street. You know, they were selling apples on the street, and they came through on rail cars, and they were called hobos. And my mother and father didn't know, my brother and I, we were about 8 and 9, we'd go over and they'd have a pot cooking with meat and we'd eat with them. And they'd talk about what they had been doing in life. They had been in business. And they were humiliated, but they knew that to keep their sanity, they had to do something that had to do with hard work. If you ever get down in the dumps, start exercising, it'll get you out of the dumps. And I weighed 260 and had hair and thought beer was food, so I can testify to that. But let me tell you, they went and did work in the Shoshone Forest and Yellowstone Park. And again, there's something averse to asking people, and Clinton helped us with that bill. There is something that you shouldn't be averse to the fact that if you're going to receive a benefit and you're hale and hearty, you should work. Because they'll always bring up the frail person who's a steel worker, and Erskine and I even dealt with that in our plan. We said, look, we're not talking about everybody staying in the workforce so they can chip into Social Security. Those that can't won't, and we'll make accommodation, and we'll give an extra benefit to those 80 to 85. All the stuff that's in there that people love to use on you as an inhumane slob, we took care of in there. But at some point, if you're going to have a recovery program, and these people are ready to work. By the way, the Disability Insurance Fund will end next year. Zero. Doesn't mean it's going to quit, but it means it's going to pay out about 25% less. And they've got to sustain it, because when people went into unemployment, and it was tough, impossible to get back, they went back to the same doctor 3 or 4 times and said, I am disabled, you're not getting the message. And they're finding those frauds throughout the country. But when a system goes over 400% usage in 3 years, something is not right. And I'm not a cruel guy. That's not my life. I'm an optimist. But for the God's sake, if you're going to do these systems, then have some kind of contribution if you're able-bodied to get in and do things like this where the need is so great, but nobody wants to take the job.
So I just have to, I mean, I agree with you with so many things, but I actually think, I mean, so something you said earlier about young people not wanting to work. The young people I see are dying to work, and I see them working unbelievably hard in college. And I think most of the people that were out of work were desperate for a job. So I think most people did want to work. I will tell you, the president very much wanted a CCC kind of thing. Like, can't we do a public employment? And I remember we looked, it's hard. I remember calling around to basically every cabinet secretary, and I had one, I won't name the agency, but I said, okay, if money were no object, how many people could you hire? And he said, you know, lots. I mean, 10,000. Like, heaven's sakes, we've got 8 million people. You know, so, and Franklin Roosevelt in a program put 4 million people to work in a couple of months, and we tried to think about how to do it. It's a heck of a lot harder.
What was the argument against it now?
I mean, in some sense, let me describe the CCC. The people you, the most of the people in the CCC were young men who were sent off to the woods to, as you said, you know, build our national parks and things. And I think 75% of their salary was sent home to their mother. And when I talk about, I mean, that was a great program. Can you imagine setting that up today? It seems, I think, the kind of issues we'd face with infrastructure, the various, you know, getting something approved is so much harder today in a way it wasn't in 1930. And some of that's red tape, and some of that's we've gotten smarter. So it was hard, but I hear you, but I just had to push back over against this sense of people not wanting to work.
Let me just mention, we do a poll at the Panetta Institute. Sylvia talked a little bit about this earlier. We did a poll of college students around the country, and for the first time, 63 or 64% said that in exchange for benefits for education, they would be willing to be part of a national service system in this country for 2 years. I think something like that ought to be looked at, certainly in terms of taking programs that are there and combining them in some kind of system that would allow young people to work in our parks and healthcare, in the Peace Corps, and in the military. I mean, all of that is possible.
The problem, let's not just focus on young people. That's a really important thing. We all care about our children and grandchildren. And for the first time in probably since the Depression, a majority of Americans polled now think their children and grandchildren won't be as well off as they are. And that's undoubtedly, some of the recession and the anemic recovery are part of the reasons for that. But we have some serious problems. But we have a lot of adults who are still underemployed or who have left the labor force. And we need growth to generate those jobs. We also have to redesign our government to be a lot more effective and efficient and much more results-oriented. We have several million jobs listing right now on the online by American companies saying they can't find workers with the skills they need. Those are not mostly software engineers. They're tool dyers and lathe operators and a lot of other things. That's part of the technical training you talked about, Bob. But there are a lot of things. We have 46 separate job training programs in the federal government in 9 different agencies costing $18 billion a year. If we had three, and most of them don't work very well, many of them don't even bother to measure what's going on with the people when they leave. If we had 3 or 4 programs that work well and got a large multiple of the people skills that could be marketed in the marketplace, mostly for private jobs where most of the jobs are going to be, we could cost less money. We cost less money, and we'd be doing our citizens a much bigger favor. That's something Republicans and Democrats should be able to agree on. And that's rife, in my opinion. Leon, you chaired the budget committee. You've dealt with budgets as chief of staff. You dealt with the defense budget, and bless you for that. Bob was right that that's the toughest job there is. But it seems to me, if you look over and over and over again, We have a lot of programs. They do a lot of good, but they have a lot of inefficiency in them, a lot of ineffectiveness. They can be tightened up. They can be targeted better. Those funds can be reallocated to the people that need them most and are most likely to benefit from them. And it seems to me that we need something comprehensive like that throughout the government.
Bob, let me ask you about that. As a result of what happened in Baltimore, there's a whole focus on, what's wrong? What's going wrong? We developed, since the Great Society, a number of programs to try to break the cycle of poverty. The New York Times yesterday had an editorial that talked about Baltimore and said that what happened was that federal programs, particularly in housing, literally failed and resulted in even greater segregation than what took place. As you know, a number of programs were developed to try to break that cycle of poverty. A lot of them have failed. What's the answer to trying to deal with it?
First of all, there's not one answer, but one of the biggest problems that we can, if we solve the this particular aspect of the problem, we have an answer, has to go back to segregation by income according to where you live. It used to be the case 30 years ago that almost every city had the poor and the rich and the middle class. Now we have entire cities that are very rich or entire cities that are very poor. And the middle class is kind of scattered and shrinking. But the concentration of poverty makes it harder and harder to get out of poverty because kids, for example, don't see any models of people who successfully make something of themselves in terms of going to college and getting work. You have the kind of, when you have entire cities like Baltimore that are basically poor, you compound the social problems of poverty because there are places in Baltimore where the lifespan, typical lifespan, matches the typical lifespan in Syria or Yemen. They're third world countries we have in some of our cities. And we always had urban poverty, but nothing to the extent that we now have. So one of the answers, and we know because we've tried experiments and they've been control groups, is to try to get people out of these concentrated areas of poverty. Whether we do it with vouchers or we do it with some other device, we just break up the concentrations of poverty. Very important.
Okay, let's turn to monetary policy. Will the Feds raise interest rates in September? Christy?
They seem pretty set on raising interest rates before the end of the year. I think September is the best guess. We certainly have been through a period what we've been talking about of the Great Recession, where the Fed has had to take extraordinary measures, and they're as ready to be done with it as anybody else. I think the trouble we're facing, I think Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, described it very well. We're kind of recovering, we're doing better, we're adding 200,000 jobs a month or more, but we've been doing that in a world with a lot, with very, very low interest rates. And so I think one of the things she's worried about is if you start raising rates, will those job growth numbers start to go down?
Let me answer. The Wall Street Journal had an editorial, I think, on this issue that basically said that, the purpose of the so-called quantitative easing and interest rates was to try to spur growth in the economy. And yet we've seen an economy that still is operating somewhere between 1-2%. And their argument was, why don't we just let the marketplace decide where interest rates should go? What are your thoughts? Ooh.
Well, I have some sympathy for that. I think in the depths of the recession and the early recovery, there was such a big gap that it was appropriate to lower interest rates to close to zero. And even the early parts of quantitative easing, which I held my nose at and weren't done perfectly, I think were desirable. I think that the commercial paper market opened almost overnight when they had their commercial paper facility, so let's not be doctrinaire about this. But I do think they now have a $4 trillion balance sheet, and they may hold it to maturity, which means it'll be much harder for private capital to come in because they're not quite sure what the Fed might do later. We're going to be down the road, interest costs are going to rise, and they're going to start taking capital losses on stuff they hold for a long period. They've made a lot of money in the meantime. They claim the way they're going to get out of that would be to raise the interest they pay banks not to lend, to keep the money inside at the Fed in excess reserves. That would be real popular politically when they start giving the banks tens of billions of dollars, given what Bob said earlier. So I think we've got a complicated thing here. I think, to use NFL language, National Football League language, it's more likely than not, more probable than not, that they'll raise that they'll raise interest rates in September, but I don't think this is going to be a stampede or even a gallop. I think it's going to be a slow trot.
You know, this goes back again, Leon, to one of the fundamental problems in the economy now, and that is lack of sufficient demand, lack of aggregate demand.
Right.
I, again, attribute that to a middle class that doesn't have enough purchasing power. But if you don't have enough demand, and you ask the Fed to bear all of the responsibility for stimulating the economy, you're giving too much responsibility to the Fed. The Fed is not designed to do that much. You have no stimulation from fiscal policy. In fact, arguably, you have a fairly austere fiscal policy in the short term. You're not exports you can't count on to stimulate the economy. What are you going to do to get enough demand going?
The biggest part of demand that has fallen is business investment in proportional terms. So business investment has fallen the most in proportional terms relative to a typical recovery. There's the biggest proportional gap. It's 1/6 of the economy, not 2/3 as is consumption. And we've got a lot of policies that are discouraging that, from our high corporate taxes to misplaced regulation. We certainly need some regulation, but anyway.
Let's question on education, higher education. Is it possible to solve the crisis of high-cost college education and mounting student debt problems without the use of public policy? If so, how? If not, what kind of policy is necessary in order to assist young people to get a higher education?
Well, I think we have to move towards some sort of, let's call it income contingent loan system. That is, instead of just having students pile up $1.2 trillion of debts in a job market that is not even now very good for young people, I think we should say, for example, you pay back X percent, let's say 10% of your full of your salary for the first 10 years of full-time work, and then at the end of that period, whatever you pay back, you will be considered to have been fully paid, so that in that way you get the investment bankers maybe subsidizing the social workers.
Bob, what's your answer to dealing with elementary and secondary education? I mean, you've proposed vouchers as a way to do that. Just give me a brief summary of that.
This is a proposal I made years ago that nobody liked, so it must be right. Must be correct. And that is a voucher system that is where the amount of the voucher is inversely related to family income. So a poor family would get, let's say, $15,000 a year voucher to spend to send their kid to a school, a school that meets certain minimum public requirements. And a very wealthy kid gets, let's say, a $3,000 voucher. And the people on the left didn't like it because it's a voucher system. People on the right didn't like it because it involves a lot of money. As I was telling Michael and a few others before, when I proposed this 20 years ago in the Wall Street Journal, I only got one person. Everybody dumped on it, which made me think it was right. But there was only one public official who called me and said he thought it was a great idea. And that was Jeb Bush. I'm not used to getting calls from Jeb Bush. In fact, that's the last time we talked. But I think we've just got to get out of the rut we're in, you know, where we're so, you know, one side said we want more tests. Well, more testing cannot be the answer. We're training a whole generation of children to take tests. We're not training them to think. We need people thinking, not taking tests.
Well,
Michael?
I would agree you want to have the right balance in testing, but I think we actually don't want to get into a situation like we got in California. We had this whole language experiment and kids couldn't read. So I think we've got to be a little careful about whether we test or not and not test. We shouldn't just teach the standardized tests. We should encourage kids to think. I think the big problem in our K-12 education for the bottom part of the income distribution and these urban areas that, that Bob has talked about is the lack of competition. What we have are monopolized school systems where we don't pay the better teachers more. People don't enter with the idea that if they do better, they're going to get their income going up. It's all on a standardized model. It's very hard to get rid of the bad teachers. And from what we know in educational outcomes, substituting an average or a better teacher for a poor one is immensely valuable to the future incomes of all the kids involved. And that has to do with actually taking on the teachers' unions, which are the reason that we're having a very hard time with things like merit pay. It's far from the only thing we need to do, and we may need to put more resources in some places and less in others. But I myself think that a large majority of Americans don't want to spend more money on a system that isn't, pour more money into a system that isn't producing results. That most Americans of whatever political party would be happy to do at least some of that if it was actually working. And therefore, I'm still big on the reform idea as part of the fiscal changes.
Can I just respond, Leon? Because I think Michael is onto something. I just want to make sure. Obviously, teachers need to be responsible. There ought to be performance requirements. But we fool ourselves if we think that we can get talented people, men or women, into the classroom without paying them more. I mean, you've got to pay people to go into the classroom.
Yeah, the good ones should be paid even more.
Okay.
That's the problem. It's hard to get people to go in if they're not being rewarded for being good, working hard, and getting better.
Alan, this is for you.
What do they do everywhere else?
Why has the size of the U.S. debt gotten 5,000 times larger since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913?
Ooh.
What created this huge debt that we're dealing with now?
Well, with my brilliance in fiscal matters and monetary policy, I mean, I didn't graduate cum laude, I graduated thank the laude. I don't understand this crap, but I'll tell you one thing. I don't know, I'm not one of those guys who say, get rid of the Trilateral Commission, get rid of the Federal Reserve, all that. I'm not one of those guys, but I am a guy that is saying, how can anybody be placing this kind of importance on a small group of people, some of them from regional areas of Dallas and Denver and so on, who are on the board of governors? Two or three of them have blown their cover already, say, we don't know what the hell's going on. And all I know about QE1 and QE2 should have been called PM1, which is called Print Money 1, because that's what they did. And maybe that's just terrific. All I know, in our work, we found that the United States has $62 trillion in unfunded liabilities. $62 trillion. That's Fannie Mae, Freddie, that's pension guarantee. List them all. List all the government-sponsored entities. Mystery land. Who cares? And let me tell you, that is brutal, but the Federal Reserve, it's like the Sundance Kid, and who are these guys?
But all right. Wait, you can do anything you want. Go work.
But let me tell you, when you have a zoo of mystery and people talking about stuff, and they guard every single sentence in their notes and their things so they can shroud the whole issue. But where the hell do you think interest rates are going to go? They're going to go to 5 or 6% because that's a history of interest. So what are they going to do? Incrementally, and then the stock market's going to go crazy? Yeah. Well, yeah.
Wait. There's just one thing. I think this conflating what's going on with the debt and the deficit and the Federal Reserve is just really not correct.
Sure is.
That the Fed is... They happen to be growing at the same time, but it is, where does the government debt come from? You've told us what it is. It's the growth of entitlement spending. It's we haven't been raising funds to pay for it, all of that. I think that the history of the last 25 years is the Federal Reserve has actually, in many ways, done a good job. I think Paul Volcker helped us to get inflation down, and that was a good thing. I think every one of us would be so much worse off if Ben Bernanke had not done what he did during the heart of the crisis. They played an incredibly important role. And so, yes, I think I have concerns. I think they could have done some things better, but to sense that they're, you know, somehow, and you ask why are they so guarded in their words, it's because every word that they say comes out in a transcript with a lag so that we can all know what they were thinking. And so this idea that it's
let me ask you, put the Fed to the side.
I think that's appropriate.
We had not only a balanced budget, but we had a surplus. I mean, Alan Greenspan was
at the end of the 90s.
We had such a huge surplus that Alan Greenspan was worried about paying down the debt at that point. And now we are back in a hole of $17-18 trillion. How did that happen?
Leon, part of this is the stimulus, obviously, but part of it also
is the recession, not just the stimulus.
All right,
the recession
was one of the reasons.
Let me, what else? Here's one for you, and this will irritate the people who haven't been irritated yet. when George W. Bush took over, the debt was $5 trillion, and he took it to 11. There wasn't a single veto of a spending bill by George Bush with a Republican Senate and a Republican House. Don't miss this. I asked some of these guys who were my colleagues, what the hell, what was this about? Well, we didn't want to embarrass the president. We didn't want to embarrass the House. We didn't want to embarrass people in our own party. I said, you've embarrassed the United States of America, taking it from 5 to 11. No, don't stop it. This president's taken it from 11 to 18. And why is it? Because they make promises they can't possibly keep, and you swallow it.
Michael and then Bob.
Just quantitatively, the recession was larger than the discretionary response like the Recovery Act. The amount of the deficit that's due to the what's called the automatic stabilizers in the tax code, revenues falling if people have lower incomes, and some automatic social spending that goes into effect was about $1.4 trillion between 2009 and 2012 or 13. So that was large, and that's always the case. What used to happen is we used to either run surpluses, or at least we had deficits that were small and smaller than our interest payments, so we'd wind up, actually, the economy would grow and we'd slowly pay down the debt GDP ratio. And we've kind of lost that discipline. We've gotten to a point where we have modest deficits in a boom and big deficits. Now, I don't want to get into the math of the difference between the deficit and the debt. I don't want to bore you. But we've sort of gotten out of the way of that. I do want to come back to the central bank for a second, because while I agree that thus far what the central bank has already done has not put any immediate pressure on inflation, that if you look at the history of world history, large deficit spending by governments then winds up getting monetized by central banks have been the history of big increases in inflation and indeed hyperinflations like Weimar Germany. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. We have tools to prevent it if we're wise enough and politically astute enough to do that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's going to be a more complicated task now. Whatever the benefits were of them doing this, it's a much more complicated task to raise interest rates and manage a $4 trillion balance sheet, which has a lot of long-run debt in it, government treasury debt, than it would be just to raise interest rates and have mostly just a small amount of short-term treasuries. Task has become more complex.
I think that's absolutely right, but I just want to make sure that we focus on what is happening in the future to our fiscal policy, to our debt. A lot of that has to do with an aging population and rising healthcare costs together. And there's not much we can do about an aging population except allow in maybe more young immigrants. In terms of healthcare costs, we are beginning to have an effect. Nobody knows exactly why. They are still rising faster than inflation, but they're slowing down. But both of those are going to be contributing to very large deficits in the future. For my sins, I sat as a trustee on the Social Security Trust. I was a trustee of the Social Security Trust Fund and also the Medicare Trust Fund. And I can tell you the Social Security Trust Fund can be fixed without dramatic changes. Medicare is a bear. And it's a bear not because Medicare is inefficient. It's a bear because of these underlying demographic forces and healthcare costs rising.
But, okay, look. We mentioned the recession. I acknowledge. So 2008 recession
hit hard, and we took that. But 9/11 happens, and we go to war as a result of 9/11. But there is no effort by the president to increase taxes to pay for the war, something that every other president in our history has done when we've gone to war.
That's right.
So we establish this kind of sense, well, we can go to war, but we don't have to make choices here. We can just go ahead and pay for that. And then a Medicare bill passed, speaking of Medicare, that increased pharmaceutical or pharmacy benefits for people, and it was not paid for. It simply went to the entitlements. So, you know, when you add all of that up plus recession, I mean, there is a lack of fiscal discipline that contributed a great deal.
Well, there's a lack of spending discipline, but let me ask you, Leon, you were Secretary of Defense. Is there any fat in the defense budget?
No. Look, thank you. You know, we took $500 billion out of defense as a result of what the Congress asked us to do, $500 billion. I think, frankly, more could be taken out of the defense budget, and we still would have a very effective, efficient defense force. I mean, the biggest problem right now in defense, as Alan knows, is the whole area of health care costs and retirement costs, which are basically eating up a big part of the defense budget. We have made recommendations to try to control those costs. Yeah. All of the groups are opposed to those recommendations. Congress doesn't enact those recommendations. So if you have this large, I mean, we're spending over $50 billion just on health care alone at the Defense Department. If you're having that kind of bill and you've got to pay that, it's going to come out of readiness in our defense establishment. So if we want to be able to control those costs, we've got to control them not only in procurement, not only in force structure, but we've also got to control it in compensation and health benefits.
Well, and this is one of the hardest issues, but also paradoxically one of the easiest issues. Health care costs. And we do not spend on preventive care in this country. Many of our health care problems can be prevented if we get diabetes, heart disease, some cancers, but we don't know, we don't do it. You know, my father, when he was 80 years old, began walking 2 miles a day. He's now 101, and we have no idea where he is. We know where he is,
I think it is also worth noting, in defense of both President Bush 43 and President Obama, right after 9/11, there was, in a national security sense, the same kind of uncertainty that there was in the economic and financial sense in late 2008. Nobody knew that this would go on for 10 years, would likely do. No one knew what the missions would morph into and what had happened, et cetera. Nobody would have predicted we wouldn't have had another major attack in the US then. We were all very fearful of that. So it's also worth noting that President Roosevelt financed 3/4 of World War II by debt. And then we then paid it off by growth and some better spending control afterwards and demobilization. I think the really essential issue is in the Defense Department as elsewhere, getting the kind of reforms you're talking about, but making sure that our readiness, our training, our equipment, and our technology is so far advanced that we have a military that we can use when we need to use it. You can argue about the missions and what politicians are doing. I don't want to discuss that now. But I think that we're in a very serious problem here. The military preparedness and training and active forces budget and equipment and technology budget is under deep threat from two things. One, inside the defense budget, the health and retirement stuff gobbling up the defense budget, and in the overall budget, general entitlements crowding out defense, which are headed to their lowest level since 1940 as a share of GDP. I'm not saying we can't save more, but we can't continue that forever.
Let me add, here's one that you...
Make it fast.
This will be the end of it. The defense budget of the United States, I think they're asking for $560 billion. The defense budget of the top 10 countries on Earth, including Russia and China, are less than that, combined. Okay? Hear that. 560 versus 530 over on the other side, 10 of the biggest countries on Earth, including Russia and China. and there were short sheeting. Now, what we did to dig in, and you were there, Leon, you couldn't do a thing because guys like me, I'm a veteran, I'm a member of the VFW and the American Legion, they will tear a guy like that to shreds. And I'll tell you why, what's happening. This thing is, there's a military retiree. There are only 2.2 million of them. If I'd stayed another few years in the reserve, I would have been one. And they have their own health care plan called TRICARE, and the premium is $540 a year. And no copay, but it went up $3 copay last time, so that's important. And it costs $53 billion, and 85% of it goes to the dependents of those guys or the guys on TRICARE. There are 64 Department of Defense schools in America. Do you know that? 64. Ann taught at one when I was at Fort Benning. They should be overseas, and they are. They're all a bus ride from a public school. And they all have a superintendent and a principal and teachers, and it costs $52 billion a year for less than 20,000 students. And then you got commissaries, which were set up as a recruiting device.
All right, except, Alan.
No. You need, it'll be
I'm down to 1 minute,
yeah,
pal.
And then you got a commissary, which is used by the old coots so they can buy their scotch in there and their lettuce for life. And you're telling me you can't take care of the Gulf and Harry Truman, you can't fuel it. That's bullshit.
I think we can blip that out. That's right. That's right. Listen, I want to thank all of you. We've covered a lot of territory, and obviously the economy is a complex issue. It's a difficult challenge for whoever becomes president of the United States, and it's going to be one of the things that a new president is going to have to confront and make these tough decisions that we just talked about. But in the end, it really is about whether or not we can make sure that young people can achieve the American dream. And that's something all of us want. So please thank our speakers and thank all of you.
I did a little ranting.